Laudato Jesus Christus. This is the English program of Vatican Radio.
Hello and welcome to our half-hour English feature program. I'm Susie Hodges. Coming up on today's program, summing up the Synod. As the two-week-long Synod of Bishops for the Middle East draws to a close, we look back at its highlights and main themes with the help of the President of the Papal Agency for Middle East Relief and Development. Missionary Zeal. The Church celebrates World Mission Day this Sunday, and we learn about one heroic priest from Uganda who embraced his mission despite the horrific experience of being kidnapped by the brutal LRA rebels and forced to become a child soldier. And who makes the news? We try to find out more by talking to a leading member of the World Association for Christian Communication, or WACC, a charity that seeks to promote democratic forms of communication. For the past 2 weeks, under the theme of communion and dialogue, participants of the Synod of Bishops for the Middle East have been discussing the situation of the Church and Christian communities in the region. But as the Synod draws to a close here in the Vatican, what were its recurrent themes, its highlights, and what is it likely to have achieved? To find out more, I sat down with one of the participants of the Synod, Monsignor Robert Stern, President of the Papal Agency for Middle East Relief and Development.
I think the biggest significance of this synod is the fact it's taking place and all these bishops from all over the Middle East, plus others, are mixing together and rubbing shoulders, exchanging views. Sometimes the most positive part of the experience is the informal contact outside the formal meetings.
Yes, I imagine. And what would you say were the recurring themes that we've been hearing the most, that have been raised the most by the participants at this synod?
There's such a huge variety. You know, the synod procedure has been to give every participant 5 minutes to speak about anything in the whole range of topics in the draft document. So there's a huge variety of points of view.
But nonetheless, there must be two or three that sort of stand out or are raised more often than others.
Well, of course, they'd be filtered a little bit through my own interests, too. But one of the things that struck me right at the beginning was, is the synod concerned with the Christians in the Middle East, or is it broader, and is it the Christians of the Middle East? And then that has interesting questions, too, because what was rather interesting was the fact that if you just do a head count of Catholics in the Middle East, including the Arabian Peninsula, half of them are really sort of guest workers. There's a huge number of Catholics from the Philippines, from India and other parts of the world working in Saudi Arabia and the Gulf. And their total numbers is almost equal to the native population. And then the other interesting thing is, if you take the, so to speak, the indigenous Arab Catholics and Christians of the Middle East, in many cases, there are more living in what some call the diaspora than in the Middle East proper, you know, in North and South America, Australia, and Europe.
Nonetheless, there are many, though, who are concerned about the dwindling number of the indigenous Christian presence, particularly in the Holy Land and in Iraq. Some people are always saying even that it risks becoming extinct within a few generations if the current trend of emigration continues. I mean, do you share those fears?
I think they're real. You know, if you look at it with the dispassionate view of a sociologist, although it's not even, there's a gradual decline in the absolute number of Christians in the Middle East and in their relative importance. It's overwhelmingly a Muslim world that they live in, with the exception, of course, of the State of Israel. And the Christians are always fewer and fewer. And it's a great concern for all of the local church.
Now, you mentioned earlier the large number of guest workers, foreign workers who come in, particularly into these Gulf countries. Is this an influx that's growing?
Oh, definitely. I mean, the number of guest workers is huge, and it raises many questions. The Holy See has made provision for them. There are two Latin bishops serving the Gulf area. But the guest workers come from many countries, and they're Latin and Eastern Catholics, and of course other Christians as well.
But is there yet the structures in place so they can practice their faith? I mean, some countries, of course, like Saudi Arabia, it's extremely difficult. Other countries, it's a bit easier. But how are they managing on the whole?
Well, the Latin bishops, the two Latin bishops that have pastoral care in the Gulf were explaining that quite a bit. They were saying, you know, some of their Eastern Catholic confreres would like to have clergy of their own church present, which is possible. But they were explaining what a delicate balance it is to have the official presence of the Catholic Church in those countries. And in some of them, fortunately, there's the possibility of having churches open. Not in all, of course.
Now, you said recently that Syria is one of the best environments for Christians in the Middle East. That's something, a statement that might take some people by surprise. So why is it, you know, in comparative terms, a good place for Christians?
Well, I guess the first observation is that it actually is. Now, the reasons, it's sort of speculation. First of all, the Syrian government, like the Iraq government before, was the Ba'athist, which is a more secular Muslim political party. And the rule in Syria is, the president is from an ethnic religious group called the Alawites, and they are a minority in the Islamic world. And perhaps because it is a minority, not a Sunni, Orthodox Sunni Muslim group, they're more conscious of the role of minorities. And they try to have a, how would you say, a more secular government. That is to say, they do not favor sort of radical militant Islamists. They try to rule with an even hand, so there's no favoring of any group. But the Christians do well in Syria. Syria is a place where there's good order. It's a stable government. Christians have their legitimate place in society. And their ecumenical relationship is superb. A good symbol for me was when the Holy Father, Pope John Paul II, visited Damascus in the year 2000. And riding in the Popemobile as he came in from the airport was the Greek Orthodox Patriarch, not the Melkite Greek Catholic. Because the three patriarchs, the Syrian Orthodox, the Greek Orthodox, and the Greek Catholic, jointly planned the entire papal visit, and three of them accompanied the priest wherever he went, and the lead companion was the Orthodox patriarch.
So a good example of ecumenical cooperation.
Definitely, yes. Definitely.
And what about in Jordan? Is it the case there that they're quite welcoming for Christians, or is it a bit more difficult there?
I think Jordan is another very positive place for my limited experience. It's the Hashemite kingdom. The King Abdullah and his predecessor King Hussein and the whole royal family are very open to the West. Many of them have strong Western connections by marriage, by education. Although there's a certain pressure on the part of, let us say, a very conservative and traditional Islamic right, still, the rights of all citizens are defended, and there's a royal institute for interreligious dialogue, and there's a lot of openness. In fact, that very wonderful document that came out called The Common Word in English 2 years ago, October, with 138 Muslim scholars addressing the Holy Father and Christian leaders around the world, the document called attention to the commonality that Christians and Muslims have. That was all developed at the Royal Institute in Jordan. So again, the climate in Jordan and Syria, although the two countries are very diverse, is very positive.
Now, of course, the Middle East, with the exception of Israel, is predominantly, overwhelmingly Muslim. How much did this synod talk about the issue of relations with Muslim? Was there a lot of concern being expressed about the rise of a more militant type of Islam?
Yes, it's been a very big topic, and it's come up. It had come up frequently in small group discussions, which is one of the working components of the synod. The Christians of the Middle East have been living in an Islamic world for a long, long time, and yet they have this consciousness that we were there first, and it was a Christian world before it became an Islamic world. From some points of view, the churches of the Middle East have historically developed a sort of defensive attitude vis-a-vis the Muslim world.
Some people would say a ghetto mentality.
Well, yes, and the ghetto in the classic sense, meaning for the security of the community, you kind of you keep to yourselves, and whether you physically have walls around it or spiritually, so to speak. But I think more and more now, the challenge is how to interact more with the Muslim world. And the document I referred to 2 years ago from the Muslim scholars was an open door, at least in one sector of the Islamic world, to say we Muslims and Christians have much more in common than our differences. And I think that's the real thrust of where we're going now. Of course, it's the politicized, so to speak, radical component of Islam isn't necessarily the most spiritual, but it's kind of usurping the name. In fact, when that document came out, that was one of the motives. They said, we mustn't let these more radical and militant people who invoke the name of Islam give the image that this is the teaching of the Prophet. It's not.
Staying within this same framework, what about the issue of conversions? This is always a difficult topic, isn't it?
Oh, it's a terrible difficult topic. Let me use an example. Jordan, which I consider very open, very stable, a great deal of openness to dialogue with Christians. But if a Muslim wishes to become a Christian, a Catholic, it can't be. It might be at the level of King Abdullah that he would be understanding, but at the level of many of the authorities, the man in the street, it's just not done. Perhaps because conversion is seen not only as, so to speak, falling away from the teaching of Islam, but you're sort of ostracized in the society because you stand outside it, because the notion of separation of church and state just isn't there. It's an Islamic society. And if you disassociate yourself from it, well, you're disassociating yourself from everything.
It's seen as a betrayal of everything.
Yeah, and it could even be life-threatening, to be honest with you, yes. You know, depending on people's reaction.
Right. Tell us a little bit about the role of the agency, your papal agency, the SNEW, in providing aid to Christians in the Middle East and supporting the Eastern Catholic churches. And your remit goes beyond the Middle East, doesn't it?
It does. Our name is sort of old-fashioned because we date back to the 1920s. It's Catholic Near East Welfare Association. Probably because the United States Congress back in the beginning of the 20th century, by a special act, had created a Near East Welfare Association, which really in those days meant Protestant missionary work in the Near East. And someone got the idea of a Catholic version of it. And later on, the Holy See endorsed this organization and made it a pontifical one.
And what kind of money are you able to provide each year?
Oh, at the moment, we operate in the neighborhood of something between 20 and 23 million US dollars as our overall budget.
And do you find that the needs are increasing each year, that you can never really do as much as you'd like to do, obviously?
If we had a budget of 10 times as much, we could spend it effectively, efficiently, and well starting tomorrow.
But how easy do you find it is, particularly in this time of the global financial crisis, to convince American Catholics to help your agency?
It's hard. It's harder than ever. And we're sort of a niche agency, you know. And yet, thanks be to God, there are many generous people who do support this good work.
Okay. Well, to sum up now, this synod is pretty much drawing to an end. At this point, what do you think it will have achieved? What do you think we can sort of say about this synod when we look back on it?
I guess, first of all, a change of mentality of the participants. You know, there's a real cross-fertilization of ideas and shared experiences. I noticed, for example, when the Middle Eastern bishops who work in Australia or Canada are speaking to the bishops who are working in Iraq or Syria, their confreres, they're bringing an entirely different point of view, and vice versa. So there's the exchange of ideas, I think, is great. But many of the bishops are saying, we need to have a structured form to continue this dialogue. Maybe a conference of Middle East Catholic bishops that will meet regularly and develop programs and institutes to carry out all the good things we're talking about, like a better biblical formation and preaching and enhancing lay ministries and common discipline and a whole variety of things that have emerged all during these last 2 weeks.
I was speaking to Monsignor Robert Stern, President of the Papal Agency for Middle East Relief and Development. Ecclesial Communion is the theme of this year's World Mission Day, celebrated on Sunday, October the 24th. In his message to mark this day, Pope Benedict urged all the faithful to feel involved in the Church's commitment to announce the Gospel, and invited everyone to offer their support to the missionaries who bear witness to Christ, often in the most far-flung and difficult places. Father Timothy Lehan is Secretary General of the Propagation of the Faith,
under whose guidance the Pontifical Mission Societies operate. He tells us the story of how the donations of Catholics worldwide have helped one young priest, Father Stefano, a former child soldier kidnapped by the LRA rebels, become a source of hope for the many children still trapped by conflict in his native Uganda.
I do not know Father Stefano personally, but I read a nice story in Fides about him lately. He says that when he was 16, he was abducted by the Lord's Resistance Army in 2003 in an attack on the Minas Seminary in the Diocese of Gulu in northern Uganda. He was kidnapped with 40 other seminarians, as the rebel group wanted the seminarians to fight as soldiers in his ranks. They were forced to leave the peace and quiet repose that the seminary offered them for their studies, for the horror and pain of the killing fields. For 2 months, he says, the killing, raping and torture was part of our daily life. The rebels wanted to teach the boys how to kill. He even saw some of his friends beaten and kicked to death in front of him. Others he saw slaughtered with machetes when they stopped walking because they could go no further in the long marches. A man cannot escape all of this, but God works miracles. Prayer was my only hope. During the long marches, I prayed the rosary using my fingers because I had no beads. 2 months after their abduction, government troops attacked the rebels, and in the confusion and fighting, Stefano managed to escape. And after walking for many days, not knowing where he was going, he was found by an army patrol. However, in this misfortune, he was more fortunate. He managed to escape before being forced to kill anyone. Stefano remembers that his parents and brothers did not want him to return to the seminary, but he knew that the seminary was his place. Most of the seminarians taken that night, he says, were eventually killed, and 12 are still missing. Today, after his long and traumatic ordeal, Stefano has become a priest. Despite all that he has suffered, he was prepared to go back on the road that Jesus offered him. By doing this, he is a testimony for all of us, as he shows a consistency in his vocation. Through your collaboration on World Mission Sunday, you help Father Stefano to continue his journey in helping others. For example, the Diocesan radio station in Lira has a special program on which family members send loving messages to kidnapped children, convincing them to come home. Messages are also sent by abducted children who have returned and want to tell their companions not to be afraid and to come home. The rebels are against these initiatives for peace, and they set fire to the radio station. But thankfully, the ERL did not burn, and with the help of missionary aid groups, this radio continues to broadcast programs helping to restore peace and reconciliation in Uganda. So let's partake actively as a family in the church in celebration of this World Mission Sunday on Sunday, the 24th of October, by reading and studying the Holy Father's message. Every year, my dear friends, your donation helps hearers like Stefano and his Bishop John Baptist of Gulu, or Bishop Francelli of Lira, or Iboro of Tamburanyambo in Sudan, and their missionary priests and religious and laity to continue to bring hope to the people of this troubled region.
That was Father Timothy Lehan of the Propagation of the Faith. Who makes the news? It's a seemingly innocuous question, but one that on deeper analysis uncovers some disturbing findings about the media and communication systems, especially in the light of the huge power and influence they exert in today's society. The World Association for Christian Communication, or WACC, is a charity that seeks to promote democratic forms of communication that are open to all and founded on respect for human dignity. It believes that communication is a basic human right that defines people's common humanity,
strengthens cultures, enables participation, and challenges tyranny and oppression. The WACC recently launched its latest Global Media Monitoring Project, entitled Who Makes the News? Their Deputy Secretary General, Lavinia Moore, spoke to me about some of the more surprising findings thrown up by this project that raise serious questions about the balance and fairness of some of today's mainstream media.
Now, your aims are to promote democratic forms of communications that promote social change. What, in your view, are some of the most glaring examples of undemocratic forms of communications in our world today?
Thank you for that question. I would refer to a report that came out earlier this year by the four special rapporteurs on freedom of expression. These are the ones appointed by the United Nations, the Organization of American States, and the African Commission on Human and People's Rights, and the Organization for Security and Cooperation in Europe. They identified 10 key challenges to freedom of expression in the next decade, and one of them was the discrimination in the enjoyment of the right to freedom of expression for women and other marginalized groups. Historically disadvantaged groups, they said, continue to struggle to have their voices heard and to access information relevant to them. And this is something that the World Association for Christian Communication has been working on for many years in a variety of forms.
Do you find then that even in Western democratic countries, there is this, should we say, gender imbalance in communications, in the media?
Yes. We just released a report that covered 108 countries around the world, including all regions, Europe, North America, Latin America, Africa, Asia, the Middle East, the Pacific and the Caribbean, and we found that while there are some differences regionally from one region to the next, overall and in every region, there is a paucity of women's voices in the news. In fact, we found that 76% overall of the persons who we read about or hear about or from in the news are male. So there is definitely a finding that women continue to be underrepresented as well as misrepresented all around the world, although, of course, there are variations from one country to the next and one region to the next.
And looking over your global media monitoring report, what were overall some of the most surprising or unexpected findings that you came across, if you could pinpoint one or two?
We found that 13% of news stories focus centrally on women, which means that 87% of news stories around the world don't focus on women. They focus centrally on men. So that's quite a glaring gap. Some of the other interesting findings were that even as persons who are providing popular opinion on a news issue in a news story, women are outnumbered by men. So they, although they are half the world's population, they're not half of the people who are giving opinion about the items in the news. And we found that expert commentary is overwhelmingly male. This is where a person in the news is giving a commentary based on specialized knowledge. We found that only one in every five experts interviewed in the news is female. Those are some of the findings that we put out in our report. There are many others, but that gives you an idea of the kind of patterns that we found.
Why do you think there is, shall we say, this imbalance between women and men, you know, particularly, shall we say, in developed Western countries where, at least on paper, you know, men and women are considered equals?
That's a very good question. We understand from people who work in newsrooms that there is always a pressure more and more to quickly get work done. People working under those circumstances often fall into routines and patterns that have existed for many years. For example, they may make use of lists of experts to go to that haven't been reviewed from the perspective of gender awareness and gender sensitivity. There is not enough attention in editorial policies and media house policies to these questions. In fact, that was one of the things that the four special rapporteurs on freedom of expression commented on. They said that they were particularly concerned about the lack of self-regulatory measures within media houses to address these issues related to discriminatory and inadequate coverage.
Now, when you talked about this low percentage of news dedicated to women, did you find that often this was so-called soft items, maybe a story about children or cooking or teaching or something that's more typically associated with women?
Yes, there are definitely differences in major topic areas. Of course, as we know, the major items that dominate the news are politics, economics, and crime and violence. And we have found that the number of female subjects or persons in the news is quite a bit less, in particularly in politics and economics, than in some other subject areas like health and social and legal, where we do find, as well as arts and media entertainment, we do find a higher proportion of female subjects in those news areas. But on the other hand, we would like to say, I mean, we did find some positive change where the number of females in the news is going up in the major topic areas of politics and economics. We did a similar study 5 years ago. In fact, we've done four now every 5 years since 1995. And we are seeing some shifts and changes towards a better balance, which is very encouraging.
And to sum up, how in practical terms do you try to achieve your organization's goals in making communications more democratic, more gender sensitive?
We work with many groups around the world, from grassroots groups that are interested in achieving better access and promoting the idea of their communication rights. We also work with professional organizations. We support projects that they develop and propose. We also do our research, as in the case of the report that we just mentioned, which we share as a basis for action. We encourage networks. We help them move forward, and we also try to enable training opportunities as well.
I was speaking to Lavinia Moore, Deputy Secretary General of the World Association for Christian Communication.
Good news, proclaiming peace.
Well, that's all for today from me, Susie Hodges, here at Vatican Radio's English programme. But we'll be on the air again at the same time tomorrow. And you can always find our programmes on the internet at www.vaticanradio.org. Laudato Jesus Christus.